Well, good afternoon. I'm Chris Fanta. It's my pleasure to welcome you this afternoon to Asthma Grand Rounds, including those of you joining us by live webcasting. And it's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dr. Jocelyn Cho, who's a graduate of the Combined Partners Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center Fellowship Program in Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine, now a member of the faculty in the Pulmonary Critical Care Medicine Division at Mass General Hospital, and in turn, Program Director for the Fellowship Program of MGH, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. And she's also an active researcher in asthma and airway biology and immunology, and we're delighted to have her here to talk to us today about the role of allergic inflammation in the pathobiology of asthma. Dr. Cho.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate the invitation and the opportunity to speak. Chris actually was my clinic preceptor as a fellow, so everything I learned about asthma is really thanks to him. So I know some people in this room have heard some of this research before, and I'm going to be presenting a story that we recently published in Science Translational Medicine, and as you'll see, this is not the work of one person, so I'll try to point out where credit is due, because this is a lot of work by a whole team of investigators. So this slide will be pretty quick for this audience. As you all know, asthma is a common disorder, and most recent CDC estimates suggest that 1 in 13 people suffer from asthma. That translates into about 30 million people in this country. Most cases of asthma are allergic in origin. So although different phenotypes or endotypes of asthma have been described, almost all childhood asthma and about 50% of asthma in adults is associated with allergy. As you all know, asthma, the cardinal features of asthma are airway inflammation, mucus hypersecretion, and airway hyperresponsiveness. And the airway inflammation seen in allergic asthma is predominantly type 2 inflammation. Th2 or T helper type 2 cells have been shown to be instrumental in orchestrating this inflammation, which is characterized by eosinophils and Th2 type cytokines, including IL-4, IL-5, IL-9, and IL-13. And patients with allergic asthma also are known to have allergen-specific IgE, which is bound to mast cells. So this is a schematic of experimental asthma, and I would say that all of these steps have not been worked out in humans, obviously, but to suffice it to say that the immune response in allergic asthma is a complex interplay between cells of the innate immune system, the adaptive immune system, and the airway epithelium. And so in this model, the airway epithelium and dendritic cells, which are professional antigen-presenting cells, express pattern recognition receptors on their surface, which are activated by allergen. And activated epithelium also produces a number of what are called instructive cytokines, TSLP, GM-CSF, IL-33, IL-25, IL-1-alpha, as well as some danger signals that activate immune cells in the airway and act to mature and activate these dendritic cells, which then migrate to the draining lymph node. And in the lymph node, dendritic cell, which has acquired allergen, presents specific antigen to CD4 T cells, which are then activated and polarized into type 2 or Th2 effector cells. At the same time, follicular helper T cells induce isotype class switching to IgE in B cells. And when the animal, or in the data I'm going to show you, humans are re-exposed to allergen, a robust inflammatory response follows. So IgE bound to mast cells recognizes allergen, and those cells produce prostaglandin D2 and histamine. Th2 cells are recruited into the airway and reactivated to produce effector cytokines. And the result of that inflammatory milieu and cytokine production is goblet cell metaplasia with mucus hypersecretion and airway hyperresponsiveness. So it's not just the immune system or the immune response in allergic asthma that's important. And this is a picture taken from a review written by Stephen Holgate, which shows a mucus plug adjacent to this epithelium, which has been disrupted. Underneath which is this hyperplastic lamina propria, and airway smooth muscle cell. And there's a lot of data to suggest that the epithelium and perhaps smooth muscle cells play a primary role in the development of asthma. So the epithelium in asthma has impaired barrier function, altered immune function, an altered mucus response, and altered repair responses. And people have proposed that smooth muscle cell can be present in increased mass and predispose you to asthma, may be intrinsically hypercontractile, which contributes to the development of asthma, and may have immunomodulatory properties. But the link between type 2 inflammation and these structural airway responses hasn't been really well worked out. We know that not all people who have allergy have asthma. So there are individuals who are systemically sensitized to airborne allergens, but when they inhale those allergens, they don't experience the lower respiratory tract symptoms of cough, wheeze, and dyspnea that characterize asthma. We also know that allergy is a risk factor for asthma. And so in pediatrics, there's a well-accepted atopic march where kids that develop eczema can go on to develop allergic rhinitis and ultimately asthma. And the same is true in adults. In this study from the Blue Journal in 2007, adults with allergic rhinitis were more likely to develop bronchial hyperreactivity over time than adults without allergy or allergic rhinitis, and those with allergy were somewhere in between. So taken together, this suggested to us that the development of allergic asthma may be an incremental process and therefore potentially reversible, and that if we could identify differences in the airway response to allergen between allergic asthmatics and allergic non-asthmatics, we might come across some fundamental understanding about asthma pathogenesis. And in particular, we were interested in looking at differences in T cell subsets between these two groups and also studying their structural cell responses. So to dive down on those hypotheses a little bit further, our group, which is an immunology group, was really interested to see whether there might be differences in either the regulatory T cell subsets or the effector T cell subsets in individuals with allergy who either had asthma or did not have asthma. And in particular, we thought that perhaps allergic asthmatics didn't have as robust a regulatory T cell response. So as you know, regulatory T cells kind of inhibit or regulate effector T cell responses through production of mediators like IL-10 and TGF-beta. And we thought that perhaps the asthmatics would have fewer regulatory T cells or that those regulatory T cells wouldn't be suppressive. Alternatively, we postulated that allergic asthmatics might have more robust allergen-specific T cell responses so that they would have a more potent effector arm, and the balance between the anti-inflammatory and the pro-inflammatory cell would be tipped toward inflammation. We also wanted to look at the response of airway epithelium to allergen, and in particular, we were interested in looking at mucus production in response to allergen, and to do this work, we collaborated with a group at the Marisco Lung Institute at UNC Chapel Hill. And finally, we wanted to look at airway remodeling, and we partnered with Melissa Suter's group at Mass General. Melissa does optical coherence tomography imaging, or OCT, which I'll talk to you a little bit more about later in the talk. But essentially, that's like using a low-powered microscope to look at the structure of the airway. So this was our study design. We enrolled allergic asthmatics, which I'll refer to as AA, allergic non-asthmatic controls, which I'll refer to as AC, and healthy control subjects, which I'll refer to as HC. Ultimately, we ended up with 36 allergic asthmatics, 48 allergic controls, and 5 healthy controls. Both the AA group and the AC group had allergic symptoms and a positive skin prick test to either house dust mite or cat hair extract. And the allergic symptoms in the allergic non-asthmatic controls were confined to the upper respiratory system, so allergic rhinitis, allergic conjunctivitis, or contact allergy. The AA group had mild asthma with a baseline FEV1 of at least 75% predicted and evidence of airways hyperresponsiveness. So for almost all of the subjects, that meant a positive methacholine challenge. There were a couple of subjects that were shown to have bronchodilator response to albuterol. The allergic controls, on the other hand, had no history of asthma, a baseline FEV1 of at least 90% predicted, and a negative methacholine challenge. And the healthy controls had no allergies, a negative skin prick test, no history of asthma, normal pulmonary function, and no evidence of airways hyperreactivity. We excluded patients who were pregnant or breastfeeding, who required systemic steroids or antihistamines, those who'd been infected within 6 weeks prior to the study, anyone who'd been treated with immunotherapy or omalizumab, and anyone who was intolerant of the medications used for the study. So this is these are some images from the skin prick testing. So on the left is a panel of allergens, and this one here is the subject's response to cat allergen. Positive response was defined as at least a 3 millimeter wheal. If subjects were allergic to either cat or house dust mite, they subsequently had an allergen, they had a skin prick test titration, which involved administering serial threefold dilutions of allergen. And this was done to define what we called the threshold dose, which was the lowest dose that elicited a positive response. And this threshold dose is the dose that we used for bronchoscopic segmental allergen challenge. So subjects in this protocol underwent bronchoscopy on two occasions, separated by 24 hours. On the first day of the protocol, we performed a bronchoalveolar lavage using 120 milliliters of normal saline in the lingula. We called this the baseline sample, and you'll see that referred to as BLN. We subsequently performed this optical coherence tomography imaging in a subsegment of the right upper lobe and the right middle lobe. And when the imaging was complete, we administered 2 milliliters of either diluent to the right upper lobe segment or allergen to the right middle lobe segment. And the diluent was essentially saline with some albumin in it. 24 hours later, the subjects came back for a second procedure. And during this procedure, we repeated OCT imaging of the same subsegments in the right upper lobe and the right middle lobe, and then bronchoalveolar lavage in both the diluent and the allergen challenge segments, each with 120 milliliters. So these are some representative images of what we see on bronchoscopy. So starting with the images on the bottom, these are taken from an allergic non-asthmatic control. This is the bronchus intermedius. You can see nice, healthy, normal appearing mucosa, very thin carina here. 24 hours later, after the allergen challenge has been performed, the allergen was administered in this segment. You can see the surrounding trauma from the bronchoscope, and that this carina is slightly thickened compared to baseline. Conversely, the allergic asthmatic, which is displayed up here in the top images, this is the same airway. We're just a little bit further down the airway, so the thin carina here is the same carina that now post-allergen is markedly thickened. The airway is narrowed, and you can see mucus emanating from where the allergen was administered. So this table is not meant for you to read, but just to show that our subjects were well matched at baseline. So they were predominantly young, mean age of 26 years. Majority were white, non-Hispanic, and there were no differences in either the type of allergen administered or the dose that was administered. The allergic asthmatic group had a lower FEV1 and FEV1 to FVC ratio, as well as a lower provocative concentration 20, which was by design. And I'd just point out that even though the FEV1 and FVC in allergic asthmatics was lower, the average was still 92% predicted for the FEV1, and the ratio was 0.79. So this protocol has been done before several times, and I think if you're familiar with the literature, you know this, but I think it's always surprising to people who don't know this literature to see that both the allergic asthmatic and the allergic non-asthmatic control develop robust inflammation in the airway in response to allergen. So on this graph, you can see, the picture first, you can see that the diluent challenge segment is nice clear fluid. We get this cloudy sort of orange tinge fluid returned from the allergen challenge segment. And on the graph on the right, you can see the gray bars here are total cell counts in the BAL, displayed as cells per milliliter of fluid for a healthy control subject. And there's really no difference in the total cells between the baseline sample and the allergen challenged segment. Conversely, the asthmatic and the allergic non-asthmatic control both have a robust increase in the percentage of cells in the allergen challenged segment. And if you look at the composition of those cells, what you see is eosinophilic inflammation in both groups. So the left is a cytospin preparation from BAL at baseline, and it has these sort of classic fried egg appearing cells, which are the alveolar macrophages. And post-challenge, you see that cell distribution has shifted dramatically. So all of these cells with pink cytoplasm are obviously eosinophils. There are a few lymphocytes here marked by the white arrows, as well as some neutrophils that come into the airway. And when you quantify this, you see that at baseline, the BAL fluid is almost entirely composed of mononuclear cells. And although the total number of those cells increases with both diluent and allergen challenge, what's really striking is that you get a huge influx of neutrophils just in response to the procedure itself. And then eosinophilic inflammation that's really confined to the allergen challenge segment. So you don't see this eosinophilic type 2 inflammation in the non-allergen challenged lung. And although the percentages here have increased in both the allergic asthmatic and the allergic non-asthmatic control, allergic asthmatics end up with slightly more eosinophils by number in response to allergen. We also looked, as I mentioned earlier, we were really interested in the CD4 T cell response. And so we started by looking at the total number of CD4 T cells in the lung in response to allergen. And here is the lymphocyte gate, the CD3 positive cells, which are alive. And we break those into CD4 and CD8 T cell populations. I'm not showing the CD8 T cells here because nothing really happens in response to allergen. But you can see that although the percentage of CD4 T cells doesn't change after allergen, the total number of CD4 T cells in the airway goes up pretty dramatically and to a similar degree in both groups. So we went on then to break those CD4 T cells into subsets. And to start with, I'm going to show you the regulatory T cell data. So as I mentioned, our hypothesis was that allergic asthmatics would have either lower numbers or less functional regulatory T cells in the airway, and that would explain the fact that they were more tipped toward a pro-inflammatory response to allergen. And you can see here that the percentage went up a little bit in the allergic asthmatic group and was actually, the number of Tregs was actually higher in the allergic asthmatics. So that didn't fit at all with our hypothesis and certainly wouldn't be something that at the surface would explain the difference in phenotype between these two groups. We also looked at the ratio of Tregs to total CD4 T cells to get at this balance question, and again, we found really no difference between these two groups. So we wondered if it's not the number, could it potentially be the function? And Sakaguchi's group had previously published that you can actually classify T regulatory cells into functional subgroups based on the expression of CD45RA and FOXP3. And in this classification system, group four are effector memory T cells, group five are naive T cells, and the regulatory T cells are shown over here in color. Group one, which is CD45RA positive, FOXP3 low, are naive Tregs. Group two are the suppressive Tregs that express high levels of FOXP3 and are CD45RA negative. And then there's this third group, which is referred to as a non-suppressive Treg group. And you can see in this flow plot here that we're able to identify where each of these three populations would be in the BAL. And so in a subset of our patients, we quantified these functional Treg subgroups. And again, subgroup two are the suppressive Tregs that we're most interested in. And you can see that in response to allergen, these suppressive Tregs increase in both the allergic asthmatics and the allergic non-asthmatic controls, but they were not significantly different in either percentage or number between the two groups. So really nothing here for less functional regulatory T cells in allergic asthmatics. And again, we looked at this balance of regulatory to effector memory cells by lumping groups one and two together and comparing them to group four. And not to be discouraged, we went on to go ahead and sort T-regs from a few of our subjects. So we did hear four subjects in the allergic asthmatic group and three in the allergic non-asthmatic control group. And these are just some representative genes that are thought to be important in regulatory T cell function, but there was nothing that fell out as statistically significant in terms of gene expression. So I mentioned then, if it's not the regulatory T cells, our alternative hypothesis was that perhaps it could be the allergen-specific CD4 T cells. And maybe allergic asthmatics have more allergen-specific T cells, maybe they're more effective allergen-specific cells. And these cells exist in very low numbers, and so they're very difficult to identify, and I would say nearly impossible to identify when you look at CD4 cells as a group. And so we did this work in collaboration with Jim Moon, who's a member of the CIID over at MGH. And he and his group synthesized a whole array of these peptide MHC class II tetramers. And they did that using specific peptides from FelD1, which is cat hair, and DERP1, which is house dust mite. And so for those of you who aren't familiar with a tetramer, this is essentially an MHC class II complex here, which has been loaded with a specific peptide. And tetramers essentially involve binding four of these complexes together and labeling it with a fluorophore here to allow for detection. And this tetramer structure allows binding to a T cell receptor with this particular peptide specificity in a stable way. And because it binds those peptide-specific T cells and has this fluorophore, you can either pull these cells down using anti-PE beads, or you can detect them by flow cytometry. And so, to our knowledge, this is the first time that these tetramers have been used to identify allergen-specific T cells in the BAL from human subjects. And this is just some representative flow. So you take the CD4 T cell population, and when you look to see whether there are tetramer-positive cells, you see this small but very clear population here. That's not present when you use unloaded tetramer or in the CD8 T cell population. So very specific binding here. And that allows us to quantify the number of allergen-specific T cells, at least to the peptides that we're using. And what we found, not surprisingly, is that the number of allergen-specific T cells is very low at baseline and following diluent challenge in both the allergic asthmatics and the allergic non-asthmatics. But following allergen challenge, you see a robust accumulation of these cells, suggesting that they're recruited to the airways in both groups. And I have to say that I think everyone was pretty surprised when we saw that there were no differences in terms of either the percentage or the numbers of these allergen-specific T cells that accumulated between asthmatics and the non-asthmatics. So if it wasn't the number, could it be the function? And how do you go about phenotyping this very small population of cells that's hard to identify? So you can do things like re-stimulate the cells with antigen or re-stimulate the T cell receptor to look at cytokine production or to look at how well the cells proliferate. But these cells have just seen a huge allergen challenge, allergen load, and so we found those techniques to be very challenging. And ultimately, what we decided to do was to look at the expression of Th2 chemokine receptors and type 2 innate cytokine receptors on these cells. And this is just some representative flow here. On the left two plots are bulk or total CD4 T cells. And you can see that using staining against these receptors on bulk CD4 T cells gives the appearance that there's really not much of anything except perhaps CCR4 expressed. But if you pull out the allergen-specific or tetramer-positive T cells, now you see a very large population of IL-33R-positive, CCR4-positive cells. You can detect IL-25R expression, as well as a pretty clear population of CRTH2-positive cells. And so using those markers, we went on to phenotype these allergen-specific T cells in a subgroup, a subset of our subjects. And just to show you how this graph is set up, the allergic asthmatics are still in red with the allergic non-asthmatic controls in blue. The The first bar here are the tetramer positive or allergen specific cells. The second bar are the bulk or total CD4 T cells. And if you look across groups at CCR4 expression here on the left, you see that there really are no differences between either the tetramer positive cells or the bulk cells or either of our two subject groups. And that's not surprising, and in fact, it fits with our findings that they both groups had similar numbers of total CD4 T cells in the airway and similar numbers of allergen-specific T cells in the airway. But when you look now at CRTH2, which is the receptor for prostaglandin D2, IL-33R, which is also called ST2, and IL-25R, you can see that in the allergic non-asthmatic controls, there's really no difference. This one maybe looks a little different, didn't reach significance. In the expression of these markers on the allergen-specific cells compared to the bulk cells. Conversely, in the allergic asthmatics, you see a significant increase in the expression of these markers on the tetramer-positive cells compared to the total population of CD4 cells. And the expression of CRTH2 and IL-33R are higher on the tetramer-positive cells from allergic asthmatics compared to the tetramer-positive cells from allergic non-asthmatic controls. So we think this is a really key finding, and I'm just going to talk through some of the data that suggests why it might be important. So we know from what's previously been published that IL-33R, and CRTH2 mark TH2 cells. And so our asthmatics express higher levels of these markers on allergen-specific T cells, suggesting that those allergen-specific cells are more TH2 polarized in the asthmatic group than in the non-asthmatic group. And it makes us wonder whether, in fact, they're more potent effector cells. Secondly, we know that there are higher levels of innate mediators in asthmatic airways. So Sally Wenzel and others have looked at the levels of innate immune mediators immediately after allergen challenge and found things like PGD2, the ligand for that CRTH2 receptor, to be higher after allergen. And more recently, William Paul's group published last year a paper which he entitled Innate Immune Function of TH2 Cells. And what he showed in that paper is that in diseases where TH2 cells are the predominant drivers of inflammation or the marker of inflammation, those cells have what he termed innate function, meaning they can produce cytokines independent of engagement of their T cell receptor. So they don't need to see specific antigen in order to produce cytokines. And specifically, he showed that that happens in an IL-33-dependent manner and that those T cells are capable of producing IL-13 and of mediating type 2 inflammation. And the production of IL-13, as I mentioned kind of briefly on prior slides, is a really is key for inducing this mucus hypersecretion phenotype in airway epithelium and has also been implicated in bronchial hyperreactivity. So we also looked at cytokine levels in the airway in response to allergen. And when we did this, we actually did a panel of 44 different cytokines, most of which have been implicated in asthma. And no matter which way you looked at the data, the same cytokines always fell out on top, whether it was by absolute level or the degree at which the level had changed before and after allergen challenge. We found very few differences at baseline. I will say that we did find slightly increased levels of IL-33 at baseline in the allergic asthmatic groups, which isn't that surprising, except perhaps I should say that BAL may not be the right compartment to look for IL-33 in. But what we found here, as you can see, at baseline, the allergic asthmatic and the allergic non-asthmatic control group have very similar levels of these type 2 cytokines at baseline. But following allergen challenge, the allergic asthmatics have higher levels of IL-4, IL-5, IL-9, IL-13, and CCL26, which is eotaxin. And I should just point out that this is a log scale. We also looked to see whether that cytokines correlated with the cellular response. And in fact, we found that the level of type 2 cytokines post-allergen correlated with the percentage of eosinophils that were observed in the allergen challenge segment. And this was true for all of those type 2 cytokines that I just showed you. And I think the interesting thing here is that this holds for both the allergic asthmatics and the allergic asthmatic control. So whether you look at the groups individually or all together, you see the same relationship. And that was also true when we looked at type 2 cytokine levels and how they correlated with IL-33R expression. So I just wanted to quickly summarize the immunology side of this story and say that what we found were important, what we think are important differences in type 2 inflammation between allergic asthmatics and allergic non-asthmatics asthmatic controls. Allergic asthmatics have more airway eosinophils in response to allergen and a more robust type 2 cytokine response. And we think that these differences might be driven by the fact that they have these allergen-specific Th2 cells, which express much higher levels of IL-33R, CRTH2, and IL-25. And that the expression of those receptors indicates that these may be potently Th2 polarized effector cells, and that they may come to the airway ready to respond to innate immune signals that are generated in response to allergen. I think the other thing that jumps out when you look at the data, particularly some of the cytokine data and even the cell counts, is that there's significant variability in the amount of inflammation that develops within a group. So you can have an allergic asthmatic with a lot of inflammation or not as much inflammation, and the same is true for the allergic non-asthmatic group. And in fact, there's a lot of overlap in the magnitude of inflammation between the two groups. And so it seemed to us that it was unlikely that all of the phenotypic difference that we were seeing between the asthmatics and the non-asthmatics was related to the magnitude of inflammation. And I would say the other take home for us was that it really appeared to be a continuum of inflammation rather than a critical threshold over which you would develop asthma. And so that was one of the reasons we were so interested in looking at the structural cells in the airway. So I said earlier that we were interested to see what the mucus response from the airway epithelium was in allergic asthmatics compared to allergic non-asthmatics. And to do this work, we partnered with Mehmet Kesmer and Rick Boucher at the Marisco Lung Institute at UNC Chapel Hill. And for those of you who are not mucus experts, which I certainly am not, mucins are the gel-forming components that exist within mucus. And so Mehmet and his group were able to measure the amount of mucin that was present in the alveolar lavage fluid at baseline and following challenge. And over here on the right are the healthy controls, and you can see that at baseline they have very low levels of total mucin, and that those levels don't change at all in response to diluent or allergen. On the other hand, the allergic asthmatics have a brisk response, a brisk increase in the amount of total mucin in the alveolar lavage in response to allergen. The allergic non-asthmatics have a smaller increase, and so the asthmatics end up with significantly more mucin in the airway compared to both the non-asthmatics and the healthy controls. And then it went on to further look at this in more detail. And so he looked at MUC5AC, which is one of the mucin glycoproteins produced by the epithelium. And MUC5AC is important because it's produced by airway epithelium in response to IL-4 and IL-13. Higher levels have been associated with human asthma, and there are recent mouse studies that suggest that MUC5AC is actually required for airway hyperresponsiveness. And so we were very excited to see that the allergic non-asthmatic controls have really very low levels of MUC5AC, both at baseline and in response to allergen, whereas allergic asthmatics have significantly higher levels. So I said early on that we had partnered with Melissa Suter and her group to look, now that we have sort of a functional readout of the airway epithelium, to really look at the structure of the airway epithelium. And in particular, she started the work looking at the epithelium and the basement membrane and looking to see if we could detect airway remodeling. And so I said earlier that she uses a method called optical coherence tomography. And I'm not an optical physicist, so I'm not going to explain this in great detail. But the way I think about this is that this is like a low-powered microscope or like ultrasound, but instead it uses laser light. So essentially, she's developed these catheters that you pass into the airway. So if you watch the video on the left here, you see this sheath that's coming in and out of the airway. You'll see it go back in, and if you watch within the sheath, you see this silver probe that's spinning and pulling back. And that is essentially using light to capture an image that has micrometer level resolution based on the scattering properties of light. And this is pretty characteristic of what we see on the screen as we do this imaging in patients. So if you watch closely here on the right, you'll see some cartilage rings pop into view right there underneath the epithelium. And you'll see the airway branch right here. And so she can use that kind of branching and structure of the airways to make sure we went into the same spot on the second day of the bronchoscopy, and then do more detailed analysis of the structure of the airway. So she and her postdoc, David Adams, who did the work I'm about to show you, I think have a manuscript in preparation looking at those changes. But while we were going through all of that data, we wondered whether or not you could actually use OCT to image the mucus that was within the airways. And it turns out that quantifying the mucus in this way is very difficult because the catheter pushes the mucus down further into the airway as you pass it. But where you find mucus, David was actually able to create an algorithm that, a computer algorithm that identified this as the catheter sheath. Here's the wall of the airway. This is the lumen. And so all this stuff within the lumen is mucus. And he can distinguish that reliably from artifact or other things. And then once he's identified the mucus, he can actually measure what's called the OCT intensity, or the mean POCT intensity of this mucus. And that intensity, based on work that's been done by others, is a surrogate for how much particulate matter is in the mucus. So particulate matter as opposed to just fluid. And if you look over here at the allergic non-asthmatic control, you see a pretty, this color scale, this yellow, is a color scale of that intensity. And so if you look here at the allergic control, I'm not sure how well you can see it, but it's a pretty homogeneous appearing mucus. Conversely, when you look at the mucus in the allergic asthmatic, you see all of these very bright areas, suggesting that those are areas with increased particulate matter or density. And so we quantified this in a subset of our patients, and you can see that at baseline, all of the subjects, whether they're allergic asthmatics, non-asthmatics, or healthy controls, have about the same mean particulate density of mucus. And in fact, allergic asthmatics are the only group where we see a significant increase in that mean OCT intensity after allergen challenge. And we looked to see whether or not this would actually correlate with the total mucin that we were measuring via Memet's methods. And in fact, we did get a pretty good correlation between this mean OCT mucus intensity and the levels of total mucin. And so we used the mean OCT intensity then to look at the relationship between particulate matter and perhaps mucin in the airway and how that correlates with type 2 cytokines. And what we found was that in allergic asthmatics, there was a good correlation between mean OCT intensity for IL-4 and IL-13. And this was not true for other cytokines, which is important because these are the two type 2 cytokines that are implicated in stimulating mucus hypersecretion from the airway epithelium. And this relationship did not hold for the allergic non-asthmatic group. And so, obviously, there's more work to be done to kind of prove this, but what we think this indicates is that the airway epithelium in allergic asthmatics is actually responding differently to type 2 inflammation than the airway epithelium in non-asthmatics. Okay, so now for what may be the coolest discovery of all of this work. So when I think Ben and Melissa had a conversation, Ben Medoff and Melissa Suter had a conversation about this project originally, Ben wondered whether it would be possible to use OCT to measure airway smooth muscle. And on the top here, you see what's a pretty standard image from the OCT that Melissa does. And if you look closely, you can see there's this thin kind of brush-like epithelial border underneath which lies this lamina propria, and you can pull out this kind of piece of cartilage here that sits underneath. And you can distinguish those things because they have different properties and they're scattering the light differently. So we know that the airway smooth muscle sits here in the lamina propria somewhere among connective tissue and glandular tissue, but it doesn't have properties that by traditional OCT allow you to distinguish where in that lamina propria the airway smooth muscle is. What David and Melissa figured out how to do is to use polarized light and the intrinsic sort of birefringent properties of airway smooth muscle to be able to detect where that smooth muscle is. And that birefringence comes from the way that the actin myofibrils are organized within the muscle cells. And so with methods that are far beyond my understanding of this technology, they were able to show that they can actually use what they are calling a novel orientation registered OCT to detect where this airway smooth muscle is. And you can see that this, this image here correlates to this histology here, and you have a remarkably consistent pattern as you see on the histology. And this is the same data just shown in an intact circularized airway. So this is airway epithelium, and right underneath it, you see where Melissa and David have pulled out this airway smooth muscle, which correlates nicely to this histology. And they did this over and over in a number of canine and swine airways and showed a very tight correlation between this methodology and histology. And this is important because, as everyone here knows, most of the studies of airway smooth muscle come from histology, autopsy, and it hasn't been possible to really image the smooth muscle in a living human before now. People have tried confocal, but that has difficulty penetrating to the depth that you need to get to airway smooth muscle. And so this really novel technology allowed us to actually image the airway smooth muscle in a subset of our subjects. And so if you look at the top images here, these are 3D reconstructions of airways. And I don't know if you can see, but there's a gray structure kind of underneath, which is the anatomy of the airway based on OCT imaging. And superimposed on that is this color scale, which is thickness. The bottom images are the same data, the same pictures. They've just been unrolled and kind of laid flat. And David went through and analyzed these corresponding 6-millimeter images to look at the width of the airway smooth muscle bands as they wrap around the airway, as well as the thickness of the muscle. And I think it's pretty clear visually that there are major differences between the smooth muscle in the healthy control subject, the allergic non-asthmatic subject, and the asthmatic. And so we only did this in three subjects in each group. I think it's an enormous amount of data analysis to get this. But you can see that there was no difference in the airway smooth muscle bandwidth or in the smooth muscle thickness between the allergic non-asthmatic controls and the healthy controls. But the allergic asthmatics have significantly more thickness and bandwidth. And just as a reminder, these are mild asthmatics who have an FEV1 on average that's greater than 90% predicted. So to summarize the structural cell data, we found both quantitative and qualitative differences between allergic asthmatics and allergic non-asthmatic controls in terms of the mucus production in response to allergen. Allergic asthmatics had more total mucin, higher levels of MUC5AC, and density of mucus measured by OCT that correlated with levels of IL-4 and IL-13, and that relationship was not seen in the non-asthmatic control group. Melissa's group, for the first time, was able to use this orientation registered OCT that allowed for measurement of airway smooth muscle in humans for the first time in vivo. And through that method, we were able to show that even mild asthmatics with normal FEV1 have increased airway smooth muscle mass at baseline. So our takeaways from these data were that type 2 inflammation is certainly necessary for the development of allergic asthma, but it's probably not sufficient. And I think that's evidenced by the great deal of overlap that we saw in the magnitude of inflammation between the two groups. And it suggests to us that in addition to that type 2 inflammation, you also need to have increased sensitivity of the airway structural cells, potentially to the allergen, but I think we feel more likely to the type 2 inflammation in order to really manifest asthma. And what we don't know is whether these changes or whether this altered response in the airway epithelium or the airway smooth muscle is something that's intrinsic to the individual or whether it's something that develops as a response to chronic inflammation. And obviously, the mechanistic links between type 2 inflammation and these airway structural cell responses remain to be worked out. So as I mentioned, this was the work of a huge team of individuals. So Andy Luster was the PI on this project and led the team at the Center for Immunology and Inflammatory Disease at MGH. Daniel Hamelos did all of the subject recruitment and skin testing. Jim Moon, as I mentioned, did the tetramer work. Mo Ling, who was the co-first author on this paper, and Sabina Islam did all the phenotyping of allergen-specific T cells. Lucas helped with the regulatory T cell data. And then we had, obviously, a great staff of lab manager and clinical research coordinators that helped with enrollment. Ben Medoff was the lead for the team from the pulmonary division. Melissa Suter and David did all the OCT work. And the last four on this list here are our fabulous bronchoscopy team, who did more than 80 procedures to get this work done. Romnick and his group helped with the transcriptional analysis from the Tregs. Mehmet and Rick helped us with the mucus data, and Bill Kwok worked with Jim on the tetramer data.
So I've watched this story evolve over the last 5 years, and I want to say it was worth the wait. Congratulations.
Yeah,
it's a really beautiful story. I have one comment and one question. The comment is that I think pulmonologists traditionally have had a view of asthma as a disease of end organ reactivity as opposed to allergy. I think they're right. I think allergy is essential, but clearly the difference between an allergic and a non-allergic is not more allergy. I have a specific question about your T-cell data. You had a very clear distinction between cells that were CRTH2 positive and IL-25 receptor positive. And as you know, the CRTH2 is now one of the markers that defines the TH2 super effector cells, which are also ST2 positive. Mm-hmm. Did you look at whether you have double positive cells, ST2 and CRTH2, in your BAL data?
I do not know the answer to that question. I don't. I'll have to get back with you about that. Mo did all of the flow and analysis, so I can't tell you. I know that image looked like they were separate populations, but I don't know whether that was representative of the group or not.
I have a closely related question. It was just beautiful. Were you guys able to take any look at peripheral blood to understand whether that the differences in T cell populations that you might see in the tissue are also reflective of a more systemic aberration?
Yeah, so we definitely did collect peripheral blood. We did not see, I think we stopped basically looking in the blood because we were not seeing differences that correlated with
yeah.
I think that I should say these are mild asthmatics. I think the severe asthmatics, it may be a very different story. And I think Lucas Faustino, who helped with some of the phenotyping of the functional subgroups, has some data that, in fact, the blood regulatory T cells and the severe asthmatics are different. But for this mild group, we didn't detect differences in the blood.
It's a wonderful talk. Thank you very much for sharing with us. So based on the data, the like a mucin MUC5AC, that possibly is a good target for the newer agent. Do we have some like trials going on for this agent?
Yeah, so I don't know of any drugs that are being developed to specifically target MUC5AC, but what I would say is that the drugs that target IL-4 and IL-13, which are thought to be the drivers of that mucus hypersecretion, may be effective in that.
Okay. What about the ASM, the airway smooth muscle?
Airway smooth muscle. We have albuterol. I mean, like, no, there is nothing real. I think the airway smooth muscle component of this is the hardest, is the one that we know least about, I would say. When you look at the literature, there's a ton of stuff about the airway epithelium and its role. There's less about airway smooth muscle, and it's because it's very hard. You haven't been able to see it before now. You have to biopsy to get it from patients, which is something that we're interested in doing. But I think it's been challenging. So I don't know of any specific targets for muscle. I don't know if anyone else does.
On that note, I guess, do you think that OCT could be used in patients with more severe asthma, thinking about candidates for thermoplasty?
Yeah, that's exactly what Melissa and David are trying to do. So they give a great talk, by the way, for future grounds. What they're looking at, I think they're going to try to use a bronchial thermoplasty cohort to kind of work this out. Melissa's paper actually shows that not only can they visualize where the smooth muscle is, but they can measure the force. There's a separate platform that they use that looks at the force of contraction, which is very exciting. But they are hoping to take this into bronchial thermoplasty. And I think in part that cohort will help them kind of further refine this technology, will define for us really what does the smooth muscle look like in a living human, but also may help to answer some of the questions about why bronchial thermoplasty isn't more effective. So they are taking it to that area.
Thanks for the beautiful talk. I have two questions. So one of your data showing that total emission levels not difference between allergic asthma versus allergic control, but you showed the significant difference on MUC5AC. So why do you think there is no difference in total emission level? And also, what's the other component?
I will say, let me just pull up the slide. So this is the total mucin, and there is a difference after allergen challenge in total mucin between the allergic asthmatics and the allergic non-asthmatic control. So that difference does exist here. So that is significantly different. I do think, and I know that and Rick think that there are probably other differences, and I think they're going to do a whole kind of proteomics analysis to see what else might be driving those differences.
Did they look at MUC5B as well?
I don't believe that they measured MUC5B here. It may be in their proteomic screen.
Yeah, I think that would be another mutation on gene you have.
Yep.
It could be interesting.
Yep.
And then the other question I have is about the baseline airway smooth muscle mass. So do you think the increased airway smooth muscle mass is the cause or the... I know the age of patients is up to 25 in average, but I just wanted to hear your answer and if you have any plan to uncover the mechanistic insight.
Yeah. I think that's a phenomenal question. I think it's a hard one probably to answer. I think one of the things that we're interested in looking at is how the epithelium is kind of orchestrating both the cellular immune response and influencing the muscle through things like growth factors and other immunomodulatory properties. I think I don't know whether it's, you know, that you're just born with airway smooth muscle mass, more airway smooth muscle mass, and so if you get type 2 inflammation, you're more likely to constrict and you're more likely to have symptoms. I don't necessarily think it's going to be that simple, as opposed to perhaps a remodeling response that occurs either from the type 2 inflammation itself or from signals from the epithelium. So yes, we hope to study it.
I just have a comment and follow-up to your answer. So one will be maybe longitudinal study. You have a beautiful method to look at the airway smooth muscle mass in intact, and you can probably trace from the beginning of their early life until like maybe 20 years later. And then the other possibility, I was wondering if you are able to get some epithelial cells from those different populations. I think that they'll be very excited to look at.
Yeah, so we do get epithelium, so we actually maybe about a year ago, maybe a little less, started adding a cytology brush to the protocol. So now, after all the BALs are obtained, we actually brush the airways. We do that at baseline and after allergen challenge. And you get enough epithelial cells that you can sort them into epithelial cell subpopulations. You can actually find a population of CD45 positive immune cells in that epithelium. And you can culture them to study them. So that's probably the next phase of this.
Thank you very, very much. Terrific.